Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barbara Cassette, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine, the author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She's also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada. In 2010-2011, Ms. Cassette reported and wrote the State of the World Population Reports for the United Nations Population Fund, the first focused on women in the post-conflict areas, and the second on the world at 7 billion. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Cassette.
Thank you.
And obviously things have moved to the United Nations. There's a sort of deja vu about this, given the build-up to the Iraq War, in the sense that there's Ban Ki-moon is pleading to give peace a chance, to wait, not to fight, but to talk, give diplomacy a chance. I believe that the UN inspectors won't be finished until Saturday. What's your sense at what's happening at the United Nations here, given the expectation that Russia and China would veto any Security Council resolution to authorize force against Syria?
Well, until, of course, we hear what the weapons inspectors, and these are good independent experts, come back with, it's sort of hard to tell where the UN will move next. And as we've talked about before, when you say UN, you're really talking about the Security Council, because the Secretary General can say whatever he wants, but, you know, the big powers will decide. An interesting thing happened yesterday, and I think this reflects some thinking in the UN. Lakhdar Brahimi, who is the UN and the Arab League's envoy on this issue of Syria, who's now moved to Geneva in the hope of convening talks later, had a press conference yesterday, and he said something very interesting. Brahimi is, I think, one of the great diplomats of a generation, a former Algerian foreign minister who speaks, you know, Arabic and French and English flawlessly and just goes from one to another. He had had a lot of trouble in the past with American administrations, Clinton administration, and certainly George W. Bush over the use of force. Yesterday at this news conference, he just threw a line away that has hardly ever been reported anywhere today that I've seen. He said, as he understands, that Obama is not trigger happy, and he used that phrase in English, trigger happy. So he feels that you know, that first of all, he's communicating with Washington, which wasn't always the case. They tried to give him orders in the past when he was working with Kofi Annan. So if that's his sense, that the U.S. can probably wait till Saturday, this is important for the U.N. and for the U.S. because, as everyone knows, in the second Iraq war, George Bush literally ordered, George W. Bush ordered the weapons inspectors out of Iraq. They did still have questions to ask. They did still have things to examine, and basically told them to get lost, then overrode a Security Council refusal to authorize this and simply went to war. This created a huge amount of bad will for the United States all around the world, and certainly in the Arab world. Now, if they build a case over a longer period of time, as George Bush won, the father did, with the Gulf Coalition, this may not be so bad. So, in other words, I think everybody is saying, what's wrong with waiting till Saturday? If the evidence has been collected, some of it is gone, some of it will never be able to be determined, you know, what's the rush? And I think this sense, that tends to be the sense of it. As you know, the Security Council has had a resolution tabled by Britain, or introduced by Britain would be a better word, and it's going nowhere at the moment. The British Parliament backed off a debate yesterday. Today they're actually discussing this. But again, the shadow of Iraq in many ways hangs over this. So how this is handled by the U.S., Iraq is very much in memory. And so the feeling is, you know, if the U.S. can sit still for a little while until the evidence is in from the U.N., then a lot of critics won't feel the same way, and the UN will be on, the U.S. would be on firmer ground, whether or not you think there should be military action. I think this is interesting because the atmosphere is very different than the atmosphere that was created by Bush and people like John Bolton.
Again, I'm speaking with Barbara Crosette, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine. She was formerly the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia, and was the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. Now, the president in an interview with PBS said, "I have no interest in any kind of open-ended conflict in Syria, but we do have to make sure that when countries break international norms on weapons like chemical weapons that could threaten us, that they are held accountable." So it seems that from the beginning, the administration has separated the war in Syria, the civil war in Syria, from crossing the line over the use of WMD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my understanding is that the British and other diplomats on the UN Security Council are trying to sort of talk about this in terms of a humanitarian disaster and suggesting that this military action would be a way to protect civilians from another humanitarian disaster brought on by weapons of mass destruction. So is that the way that they're trying to finesse this?
Yeah, this is interesting, and you probably heard and noticed today the French are kind of backing away a little bit from what was a slightly more hawkish pose a few days ago. But for the British today released two very interesting documents. The Joint Intelligence Committee's sort of survey of the situation from an intelligence standpoint. But the other one, it's interesting, and this goes to your point. The other one is basically the British government's reasoning for why military action could be undertaken. And in all the three conditions, it says a legal basis is available under the doctrine of humanitarian intervention provided by three conditions. And every one of those conditions mentions humanitarianism, extreme humanitarian distress on a large scale, no practicable alternative to the use of force if lives are to be saved, and proportionate to the aim of relief of human need and suffering and so on. So, you know, that they're building their entire case, at least officially, in these documents released today in Britain.
Well, this, of course, is the doctrine that Samantha Power and others are famous for, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. And more recently, the interest in this responsibility to protect doctrine, which was adopted by UN member nations in the General Assembly, which means the majority of countries in the world, in 2005, the responsibility to protect has a lot of ifs, ands, and buts in it. But it's often quoted as a reason. And there was a huge argument after the invasion or the military action in Libya about whether this was a responsibility to protect. It's called R2P by the people who talk about it. That had gone horribly wrong, and it became regime change. And not just Russia, but India was violently against this whole process being tried elsewhere because they saw it as a wedge. You call it the responsibility to protect or humanitarian intervention or whatever you want. Next thing you know, you have a new government. And, you know, a lot of countries in the world don't like that precedent.
So how, Barbara Crosette, again, the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine and formerly New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations, how do you see Samantha Power handling this job? She was actually on vacation. She had to come back because
right.
of this crisis. I met with her some years back, and she struck me as being extremely bright, but in a somewhat academic way. She certainly doesn't have the experience of a Thomas Pickering. How is she handling the job?
Well, it's been awfully short. I mean, just a matter of weeks, if that. And then she did go on vacation. She's been in the Security Council. I know there have been reports in the media that she's taking instructions directly from the National Security Council in Washington about how far to go, how bold to be, and all those other things, and what to commit the United States to.
But that's how business is always done anyway, isn't it?
Exactly. But, you know, there were people who thought that because she was so outspoken and so overpoweringly vocal on this question of genocide, humanitarian crises, and so on, that she would be a little bit of a freelance operator. And I guess it's just far too soon to judge her. I haven't noticed anybody saying that, you know, she's in any way getting outside the American line. Now, if the Security Council starts some real backdoor bargaining and so on, that will be a huge test of her diplomatic skills, of which she has no track record.
Well, but Susan Rice, who's ostensibly her boss in the sense that she's would be issuing the orders or what to say and what not to say,
right.
They're on the same page with R2P, aren't they?
I mean,
Susan Rice is the person who was haunted by the Clinton administration's lack of action on to stop the Rwanda genocide.
That's right. And Susan Rice is not a person who likes to be upstaged. That was clear when she was in the job that Samantha Power now has. So Susan Rice also has to establish herself as a strong and credible and sort of better than good national security advisor in this particular kind of situation. So, I don't think there necessarily would be any tension. We all remember that picture of the two of them with their arms around each other and Obama walking out of the White House Rose Garden after their appointment. So, I mean, they do. But, you know, Washington is Washington, and people can get extremely thin-skinned, and people can worry about their own positions. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Because, you know, I was there during the time Madeleine Albright and Richard Holbrooke could barely tolerate the sight of each other. And yet there was really nothing different about the way they felt on numerous issues.
Well, but when you talk about the personalities and people feeling the need to assert themselves and to lay down the red line as the president has done, it's a pity in many ways that he didn't lay that red line down in a more less unilateral way by saying if the line is crossed, this will have to invoke the UN and et cetera, et cetera. He's basically drawn the line in the sand that more or less says that the United States is the international humanitarian cop on the beat.
Right. Well, this is another one of those things that was supposed to have happened between Washington and New York in the U.S. mission over last weekend. At the end of last week, he was interviewed by Chris Cuomo on a CNN program, and he did say something about waiting for the UN or getting the UN behind us, meaning, of course, the Security Council. And then the implication was waiting for the UN inspectors to come to some conclusions while they were being, you know, sort of dawdled around in Syria by the government. But the report after that was that he's never said that since, and that sort of people closed around him and said, don't say we're waiting for the UN. This doesn't go down in the United States and certainly doesn't go down in Congress, which is another whole story about what happened to the UN's reputation during the Iraq War in the United States political system.
Well, also, I imagine that psychologically they want to put as much pressure on Assad as possible.
Yes. Oh no. Oh, absolutely. But as I said, you know, it's sort of different. I mean, it's different than the tension before the Iraq, even the earlier Iraq attacks in the '90s when the U.S. was bombing. They bombed at one point various offices in Baghdad and people there. I was there in '98. People said, I mean, they practically could choose the file drawer on some of these things and get rid of the, you know, what they wanted to get rid of in the weapons program. So, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of, and I think there's almost less tension now. I'm not in Damascus, so I'm sure the people there are quite concerned. And obviously the Israelis are concerned. And Lebanon, you know, always gets sort of stomped over, like when the elephant crosses the fields, you know, and so there are lots of neighbors. But Turkey is being pretty belligerent, at least a few days ago, on this. And so, you know, it's interesting to see. But, Obama surely wasn't counting on having a second term battling another Middle Eastern war or military action. And in a way, he's, as I said, on a learning curve himself.
So Barbara Cassette again, UN correspondent for The Nation magazine and formerly The New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. Do you think that there's a consensus, at least amongst the French and the British and the Turks and the Americans, about simply being fed up with Assad? I mean, as much as many voices on the left make excuses for Assad and for Gaddafi, in this case, I think it's fair to say that Assad brought most of this tragedy that's destroyed his country on himself because he's a dictator, and so was Gaddafi, and that dictators destroy countries, they destroy any possibility of a political alternative. So you can't expect people, you can expect people to rise up, but on the other hand, you can't expect democracy to flourish immediately. There's a huge vacuum because people have been lobotomized and the opposition has been eradicated. And this guy's had any number of chances to mediate, but instead he's decided to go, it's all or nothing, and to exterminate the opposition rather than negotiate with them. So that has been pretty clear all along. It's also pretty clear that it's much more likely that the regime has chemical weapons, and it's extremely unlikely that the rebels have them. You have to do a lot of mental gymnastics to figure out how these ragtag, 2,400 little bands of rebels could have gotten hold of WMD. So is that a subtext here? Are people just fed up with Assad?
Oh, I think people are astonished on one hand that he let this happen. I mean, this is, of course, the legacy of his father, you know, who went out and murdered, I forgot how many people in the city of Hama, when he was in power. And so the idea of annihilation being a policy of dealing with political opposition is not new. But I think astonished one and horrified that he would really do this. It's hard to believe that it could have been the rebels. In the joint intelligence report that the British government released today, or whatever they released of it, I mean, it's a clear sentence. There is no credible intelligence or other evidence to substantiate the claims of the possession of CW chemical weapons by the opposition. The JIC, that's the Joint Intelligence Committee, has therefore concluded there are no plausible alternative scenarios to regime responsibility. So that's laid out as British policy.
Well, the fact that Putin has been silent on this would indicate to me that maybe Putin knows that his side screwed up. And that, you know, one of the theories is that, of course, that the brother Maher did it, and, you know, Assad didn't necessarily approve of it, but it's too late now.
Yeah, this is interesting. I don't know how you feel about this, but those of us outside the intelligence sort of, you know, insider networks are amazed at how little is known about the sort of inner relationships in that regime, and also whether there are other shadowy people in the military who may be, taking on themselves some responsibility for some of these things. It's very hard to tell. And as an outsider or as a consumer of information, and I don't see very much of it coming out even now. That will have to come later. No, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, people are not only fed up, but as I said, just scandalized and horrified that, you know, that a country that was, you know, coming along reasonably, I mean, it had no political opposition, should do this. I mean, Mubarak never did anything like this. And neither did Ben Ali in Tunisia, and on this scale and with this kind of horror show. And so along comes Syria, and it just astonishes everyone. Now, whether, and you know, even Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has said, we really want a political solution, which would indicate that they know, a lot of the Russians know that, but they can't deliver Assad at all. And so this is, you know, doubly awful. And today, you know, the president of France also said that the only way out of this is a political solution. Well, you know, there's a problem there. And Assad may bring down his own regime and maybe his death if he refuses to acquiesce to that. I think we all think American military action in the short term, and British or Turkish or whatever, would be pinpoint. It wouldn't be, you know, there's no invasion or anything like that. It'd be hard to invade anyway, because what would you do? But to knock out, you know, chemical plants, defense establishment places, a no-fly zone, maybe shoot down aircraft, I mean, that, which is what they did in Libya, is probably what they're thinking about. And again, I go back to my original point that, well, can't this wait 3 days? And then once the UN says something, and then a lot of people, the wind will come out of a lot of sails. And you know, all those people you talked about, left-wing opponents of these military actions, are actually anti-war people. And in some ways, the anti-war people are as ignorant of what is, or willfully not paying attention to what what the reasons are for this in humanitarian terms. As are ignorant the people on the right wing who just want to go over there and lay waste to Syria and not understand the consequences in the neighborhood. So, you know, there's a lot of hot talk on both sides. But I do think a lot of the people protesting today in Britain, and it will eventually happen outside the UN, or as I guess it's happening, it will happen in Washington, are just anti-war. I mean, they're anti-involvement in another Middle East conflict.
Well, so is the head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon. I mean, he's saying, give peace a chance, give diplomacy a chance, stop fighting and start talking.
Right.
Who can argue with that?
No, well, Kofi Annan said that also. And, you know, even before him, Boutros Ghali got into trouble for various things. You know, they're long, old stories. But, you know, but Ban Ki-moon is known to be much more of a compromiser if you're really critical of him. But I think conciliator and consensus seeker is maybe what he would think he is.
Well, Barbara Cassett, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barbara Cassett, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine, the author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later became the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She's also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to a retired U.S. Army colonel who has questions for President Obama before he pulls the trigger.